You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we're less than 2 months out from the midterm elections. We'll get an update on how the race for governor is shaping up. First, Nike debuted a new ad campaign last week that features former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick. Kaepernick has been at the center of a national debate since 2016 when he began kneeling during the national anthem before games, trying to call attention to the unequal treatment of African Americans in the U.S., particularly in terms of police violence. Nike's campaign includes a print ad and a TV commercial that premiered during the NFL season opener on Thursday night.
Don't believe you have to be like anybody to be somebody. If you're born a refugee, don't let it stop you from playing soccer for the national team at age 16. Don't become the best basketball player on the planet. Be bigger than basketball. Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything.
The ads led to a range of reactions, from praise for Nike to people swearing off the company and destroying their products. Others are questioning whether Kaepernick's message can survive a corporate endorsement. Tyler R. Tynes is a staff writer for SB Nation, where he's been covering the intersection of race, politics, and sports. Tyler, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, you've been following this story, as a lot of people have in the country. What do you think of Nike putting Colin Kaepernick front and center in this ad campaign?
I think it makes sense. I think it makes sense for Nike, for their profits, for their margins, for anybody who is allegedly stuck in the middle of this, who believes, especially white consumers, who believe that they want to do something or they're empathetic to this cause but don't have a way to really support or don't really necessarily agree with protest. And so Nike can hone in on all of that by being the biggest beneficiary of all of this and say, you know, here's this product, here's this, here are these ads, and here's things that you can kind of get behind. And, you know, you might like that. You might get that. But the winners of this aren't black people. They aren't people of color. They aren't black athletes or the springtime of athletic, of athletic resistance. It's nothing like that. In the most generous rendering, Colin Kaepernick is increasing his message through a branding opportunity, but he's abdicated his career and risked his life to remind the country of the injustices that people have faced, because we have to understand, at the bare minimum, capitalism is only a game.
So what do you think of Kaepernick's decision, his personal decision to be involved with this? Some people have criticized him for, as you're hinting at, kind of letting his message be co-opted for commercial gain. Yet on the other hand, it's renewing this platform.
I mean, historically, capitalism has taken so many different black athletes and people of large black allure. So nothing of this is surprising, right? Black athletes and black protests has always been defanged by white politicians, white corporations, et cetera. And so none of that should be surprising, nor should it be alarming that a man like Colin Kaepernick, who lost so much profit and so much revenue standing for black and brown rights, is not able to actually profit from protest, at least in some manner, right? In the opposite way, we've seen Spike Lee and Nike commercials with Michael Jordan. We've seen Charles Barkley indignantly blare in a Nike campaign that he's not, you know, our role model. We've seen Orenthal J. Simpson and Hertz commercials. We've seen this happen numerous times, and the fear that I have for Colin Kaepernick is that he's marrying such a flawed entity, Nike with its sweatshops, Nike with its capitalistic gain, that because the black athlete has been repeatedly used by politicians and corporations forever, we don't really want to see the end or the defanging of such a powerful moment, not only in American history, but during a decade of protest where radical action is the only thing to be desired by black constituents.
What is it that made this issue so powerful, so controversial, these protests during the national anthem protesting unequal treatment of African Americans? What is it that made this such an issue that we're still talking about it?
People still get murdered. And so you can look at the issue in Dallas where a white police officer walked into a black man's home and murdered him as he was living there. And I think to the umpteenth at this point, evidence just keeps piling up that we cannot, you know, go to the store and buy Skittles and iced tea. We cannot buy cigarillos. We cannot do almost anything under the guise of Americana without being afraid for our lives. And even to this point, at this moment, we can't do the right thing if you're Philando Castile, and you cannot sit in your home without a police officer barging in and taking your humanity from you, kidnapping your soul. And so that's why this still finds allure, at least in so many different parts of America, is because America has not truly grappled fully with the fact that officers of the state are extrajudiciously killing black and brown people disproportionately compared to white people and specifically unarmed. And so that's just one of the issues before you even mention equality when it comes to education, upward mobility, and a plethora of other things that are keeping black people specifically indentured in America's states. And if that's the truth, then the people who haven't grappled with the entirety of this message and have left it only to a form of white patriotism, they're never going to understand, and they're always going to whitewash the messaging.
Talking to Tyler Tynes from SB Nation about Nike ads featuring Colin Kaepernick. Tyler, at the end of last year, you wrote a piece on race, sports, and politics, making the point, among other things, that we're not in a new situation here with these Colin Kaepernick stories. This goes way back. And you wrote in that piece about some of the earliest black football players in the late 1940s and 1950s to play with white people and how they were targeted on the field during plays, sometimes between plays. Can you tell some of that story?
I mean, this has been the history of black footballers within how football has operated in America forever. I mean, if we can believe that black people were kidnapped from Africa's shores and brought here, made the toil in America's fields and labor without payment, and stripped of their sanity and their sanctity only at that point for sports to be introduced to the plantation, it starts a troubling timeline across history where black people and black football and black athletics have never been prosperous to the black body. And we've been under this false pretense that football is actually for the black body when that's not true. Johnny Bright was attacked by a football player who was endorsed by the Klan in Louisiana, and his jaw was broken in front of reporters in a trick play. The activist Paul Robeson had his fingernails ripped from his hands in 1912 at Rutgers attempting to play football. Jack Trice was killed at Iowa State. Greg Page was killed at Kentucky in 1967. SMU had massive issues. Daryl Hill had issues in Maryland in the 50s and 60s. And so this is just the truth of where we've been at before you even go into protest of what black footballers have been able to do. And so I think by ignoring that or being oblivious to the history that we have here, we don't really remember everything that's going on. I mean, Lenny Moore, who was a tailback for the Colts in 1961 in Roanoke during an exhibition game between Baltimore and the Steelers, saw Jim Crow seating. Local NAACP chapters filed lawsuits. The NFL said that the problem was going to be resolved. He went into the stadium and saw that there was still segregated seating. And he said that he had to reach through a chain link fence in order to shake the hands of the black people who were there. And no image had ever made him realize with such force just what black people have been up against through American history. We have always been on the outside looking in. And if football is a tool and a tutor for all of this, we should only see a cycle of the same exact thing where a day of reckoning came to football. Everything was co-opted and gentrified and whitewashed and given back to the white majority, and still black people find themselves unequal.
Why do you think that whenever a new story like this comes along, it seems new and fresh, given some of the history you just laid out there?
It feels new and fresh mostly for the fact that it would seem that white people are living under this fictive missive that none of this has ever happened. That egalitarianism can exist in the United States, that we can be post-racial, that we are living in equality arm in arm with black and white sisters together, holding arms and running into this fanciful meadow of fake dreams. And that's just not true, right? And equally that the majority, white people, do not have to live in the same horrors that black and brown people have to experience every single day in America. And if that's also true in the way that we are teaching our history to our kids, the way we are raising each generation, this same fanciful dream is being given over and over and over again with no one upending the status quo. So it takes something like not only the civil rights movement, but also this decade of protest, but also men like Colin Kaepernick, like Eric Reed, like Russell Okung, like Kenny Stills, and et cetera, to continue to kneel and give black power salutes, but specifically to kneel and have radical action enter these byways of American lore where people think they can escape politics, but the reality is that politics can be escaped by no one and nowhere.
What would you like to have seen from the NFL as an organization and from team ownership when this first started?
If they would have cared about black people, if the NFL had just maybe even just at the bare minimum said that they see what is going on, said that there is validity to what their players are preaching, then maybe at the bare minimum that would have been acceptable. But what we had here really was the NFL basically saying that none of this existed and they wanted their players to stand. And with the 2016 election happening, Donald Trump used his version of white supremacy to really keep black free speech docile. And if you look at that piece in the Day of Reckoning in SB Nation, you kind of start to see through that theory and that formulation that again, this is cyclical. It always takes something like this to get to the highest climax of black protest and radical action for it then to be stripped back down and refed back to the majority. And so still, here we are in season three, since Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reid originally took a knee to protest, not the national anthem, not the Star Spangled Banner, but during it, the injustice is going on to black and brown Americans here. And we're still seeing that people don't understand the message. Polls show that. NFL players show that. NFL owners are saying that. And now they just want to return to normalcy, which is a reality of how we have these things happening.
We're talking with Tyler Tynes, staff writer for SB Nation, about the reaction to Nike's new ad featuring Colin Kaepernick that says, quote, "Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything." You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this ad? Is it smart business by Nike? What do you think of the wider issues that are attached to it here? What do you think the ad means for Kaepernick's stated goal of bringing attention to police violence, among other issues? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Tyler Tynes, staff writer for SB Nation, about Nike's new ad with Colin Kaepernick and the reaction it's getting. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you glad to see this or upset to see Nike using Kaepernick in its ads? Good move on Kaepernick's part, on Nike's part. And what do you think of the ongoing issue of these protests by NFL players, African-American NFL players in particular, during the national anthem, trying to raise awareness of issues of racial inequality? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. David is on the line in Oshkosh. David, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So when it comes down to the people that are offended by this ad, it always goes back to somehow it's disrespectful to the members of our military. So every time I hear somebody talk about this, you always hear they say, all the veterans I talk to say this, or all the veterans I talk to say that. So I created a poll on Facebook and prefaced it in big, bold letters, only vote if you are active or veteran military. Now, I realize this isn't very scientific, and I can't monitor that very well. But as of this morning, before I had started, and it was a simple question, are you offended by the Kaepernick Nike ad, yes or no? Before I went to work this morning, there was just shy of 1,100 votes on it. And as it sits right now, 65% of respondents are saying no, they're not offended. Vast majority of them being actual veterans. And I think that's important for a lot of people to know that the majority of veterans don't seem to be bothered by this.
David, thanks for that call. And this is one of the big criticisms, Tyler, that, okay, whether or not we like what you're protesting about, critics say, not during the national anthem. That's, that's a time where we honor U.S. veterans. What do you think of that part of the debate?
What I don't think people get is that it doesn't matter whether active military or veterans care or don't care. It doesn't matter. So by running to them and asking them, do they care? And if they say, "Harumph, we don't," I mean, that doesn't matter, right? I mean, people are being murdered. That's the end goal of this. If we are going to war for sanctimonious reasons and we're also murdering people, then we should care individually and domestically that people are equally being murdered by enforcers of state and government law. And because of that, we have to understand equally that protest is about disruption and dissent and upending the status quo. So it doesn't matter if you care or not, but by you responding, it's touched a nerve in some way, or you're defending the thing that has touched a nerve. And so if you agreed with the protest, we wouldn't be here. That's the whole point of it.
David, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Rich on the line and Nina. Rich, hi.
Hello there. My take is that, first of all, the NFL – if I'm not mistaken, their rules state that they are supposed to stand at attention for the national anthem. If I were to disregard some of my work policies in that, I could be dismissed. Second of all, John Elway had even mentioned that the Broncos had offered him a contract, and he turned it down. And I think that's part of that is so that he can stay unemployed to bring more attention to his cause.
All right, Rich, thanks for the call. Tyler, Rich says it's a workplace issue. These are NFL guidelines. You follow them or you risk being fired.
Okay, so this is a little dumb for a few reasons, right? First, the Google machine will tell us that John Elway gave Colin Kaepernick an option to come to the Broncos before his protest started in 2016 and for low below the wage that he was worth. Why would you take a job that doesn't meet to your actual criteria or standards? That's one. Easily debunked, 5 seconds of Google. Part two is millionaires don't adhere to the same rules as regular people. And so if you break your rules at your office or wherever you do work and you get fired, I mean, that kind of sucks, right? We don't play by the same rules if we're dealing with actual entertainers, millionaires, and people who pay different taxes than you. And so just because you have to live to a certain standard doesn't mean somebody else does. And at the end of the day, the same issue is the same of people are being murdered. And so if people are being murdered and you feel strongly about that because they look like you or your family member or your mother or your father or could have been you or you've been stopped by police or you live an identity in a reality that is different from the usual white person in America, well, then maybe you feel compelled to do something about that. And at times when your humanity is on the line, it might be worth your job.
Rich, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Jane on the line in Sun Prairie. Jane, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I love Tyler. He is the first one that has articulated what I've been thinking this whole time. I first want to say that I think the NFL should be protested against because they didn't, from day one, say that we support the minorities in our country and on our teams, and we are intelligent, and we know that they are protesting the kind of treatment they get, and especially police brutality. And that's why I think the NFL should be protested against. And instead, they've weakly adopted Trump's narrative that this is, oh, boo-hoo, somehow against our flag, our nation, our veterans. That is such a false narrative, and people have just sucked right into it. They're racist. They're inherently racist. I, for one, a very, very lucky person that I was born not a minority except for the woman part of me, am stunned on a daily basis how minorities don't protest every day. It's stunning to me that they are as peaceable as they are. I don't know that I would be as gracious.
Jane, thanks for the call. Tyler, your thoughts?
I think the thing here is that the NFL has found a way to alienate its really any diverse moment of its fan base so frequently, right? They don't care about where the black fan is at this point. They very much don't care about where female fans are in the same expanse. And so if America's church is alienating 70% of its potential consumers here, including Latinx people as well, they're only really making a product for cis hetero white men, mostly skewing Christian. That's not a product I really want. And if I wasn't from Philadelphia and my Eagles didn't just win the Super Bowl, I definitely would find it much, much more harder to continue to watch football. And I think that's something that we should continue to grapple with. This shouldn't just be a blanketed answer, right? If black players are saying they are being treated unfairly, and the first thing that you can think about is a white missive about a flag or an anthem or America's first song, then you are missing the entire concept of the point. But to other people, it becomes harder and harder to continue to watch and absorb this product. Mostly for the fact that the product ain't good. I mean, you can watch college football, and it's a lot better than what we're getting on NFL Sundays. I mean, ask a Lions fan. And so there really is not a reason outside of the fact that America's blood pact with football is so strong that we're never going to detach ourselves from it until we truly see somebody get killed on a field in primetime football. And even then, I don't know if we'll detach ourselves from it.
Do you think that there's another professional sport that has handled some of these issues, if not perfectly, better than the NFL?
No professional sports league has handled this well at all. Baseball sanctimoniously has ousted the people who have done so, and the people have stopped kneeling. Hockey, numerous players have talked about maybe doing this, and they were told they'd be banned from their international teams and would not play on regular rosters, and they got death threats as well. Or it's such an international game that black Canadians and black Europeans are saying they really don't have the same qualms because they're not black Americans, which is understandable. And in basketball, they've had a longer anthem policy on the books than NFL has. And after a call to action from LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, Carmelo Anthony, and more, the NBA has not lived up to its standard of having eloquent black players speak about these issues. But when you get to cities like Sacramento, when Stephon Clark was murdered in this year, those people, the constituents of those teams, are saying, well, what more can be done? And the players are saying, we've done it perfectly. And so, no, at least within football and the conservative vehicle that the NFL is, breeds, and uplifts, they've never pretended to care about the black body politic. And if that is to be true, then we must look more at places like the NBA, who would easily say they're doing well, but restrict their players more when it comes to radical protest. And so every league here is at fault, because no league is uplifting or even attempting to uplift the message without coming at the very bare minimum. And usually it's reactionary than it is for being progressive.
As a sports writer, as a, I think a sports fan, if maybe ambivalently some, Tyler, do you ever think of just giving up on the big leagues?
I do. And when you look at the football, the college football deaths that have happened every single year, when you look at things like Maryland and Jordan McNair, when you look at how the Olympics are formatted and poor people have to suffer while stadiums get built, when you look at the meritocracy that is holding down a lot of black lives in these different sports, when you look at the wage gap between the WNBA and their black players and the women there compared to NBA players, when you look at the fact that women can't even play hardball at a professional level that is looked at in the same way as Major League Baseball, it is often, daily, very hard to believe not only that I write in this profession, but also that I can still enjoy sports. And so that is a thing that I grapple with either daily or weekly. And I doubt I'll ever stop being a sports fan. I'm a Philadelphian, and sports are really what we do. But at the same time, I think it would be wrong not to question sports' hold on the world that we have, specifically the country that we have, and try to poke holes in the logic that these corporations and these leagues feed to American citizens, because at the end of the day, though sports have existed for the entirety of American history, it's not everything in the world.
We'll leave it there, Tyler. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tyler Tynes is a staff writer for SB Nation, where he covers the intersection of race, politics, and sports. We were talking about Nike's new ad with Colin Kaepernick and the reaction athletes get when they speak out on political and social issues. Now, in less than 2 months, Wisconsinites will head to the polls to cast their ballots for a number of state and federal races. One of the biggest and most contentious right now is the race for governor of Wisconsin. Incumbent Scott Walker is on the Republican ticket. State Superintendent Tony Evers won the Democratic primary, and both candidates have been taking swipes at each other since they locked down those nominations. Our next guest is here to break down the ads, the news, and the controversies in the race for governor. J.R. Ross is editor of Wispolitics. J.R., welcome back to Central Time.
How are you doing today?
Well, pretty good. Now, let's start with the polling. What are we seeing in this race?
You know, it depends on which poll you look at, and you got to remember that these have been kind of spread out, but they've shown a fairly tight race. Now, there was one at the end of July that had Tony Evers up by 13 points, but since then we have one from Marquette University Law School that had it within margin of error. Walker, you know, a two-point edge that was well within the margin of error in that one. And then you had a Suffolk University / Milwaukee Journal Sentinel poll that had Evers, you know, a two-point advantage, again, in the margin. So, really, you know, polls, they take them with a grain of salt because, you know, what happened in 2016 and other things. But just look at the TV ads. That tells you what's going on. It is a very close race. A lot of national interest here. I mean, a lot of money spent between now and Election Day on who's going to be the winner of that contest.
Right. If polling seemed to show one side or the other just running away with this, we probably wouldn't be seeing this level of national interest, this level of spending and ads, right?
No. And one consistent theme, though, in the polls that I've seen has been that Scott Walker is having difficulties with independent voters. It is basic math in Wisconsin politics that if you're a Republican running statewide in a year that could, and I stress could, be good for Democrats, you have to do well with independents. So if that persists, Walker's going to struggle. That's also why you're seeing the slew of attack ads against Tony Evers so far, both from the Wisconsin Republican Party, Scott Walker, and now the Republican Governors Association, all hitting Evers on this teacher license issue, because it's kind of politics 101. If you're a longtime incumbent with very high name ID, it is harder to move your numbers than it is to tear down the other guys through ads.
And have we seen responses in kind from Evers and the Democratic side?
Yeah, we've seen the Greater Wisconsin outfit. We've seen the Democratic Governors Association both running ads defending Evers on this issue. I mean, this issue is, it takes a while to explain, but, you know, if you go back, the overview is that There was a teacher in Middleton Cross Plains who was caught viewing pornography on a school computer, made inappropriate comments about young girls' bodies. The school just wanted to fire him. It was overturned by an arbitrator, went through this whole process, and at the time, DPI decided it could not pull his license because of the law in place. They've changed the law since then, but, you know, the Walker Republicans keep arguing that Evers should have done it anyway, let the courts decide and push it, and because he didn't, they make this argument of he left students vulnerable. The difficulty of Tony Evers is this. I've learned in politics after all these years covering it, if it takes you longer than 30 seconds to explain anything, you're losing people's attention. And what's 30 seconds? A TV ad. So it's difficult for Evers at times to make that kind of argument of, well, the law was different back then, we've changed it since then, and trying to explain it. And Republicans, they keep telling me this is their best, the best punch they have on Evers, that this is moving voters to make this attack. And so we'll see if it plays out. We have not really seen a good number of polls post this run of ads. But what I'm watching for is, does this flight of ads move numbers in this race and really flip things for Evers, especially the independent voters?
Here's a bit of that ad that's been playing quite a bit lately.
Suggested one struggling student should brush up on her sex skills because it's the only thing she'd ever be good at. Then intimidated the female teacher who complained. Tony Evers should have revoked the teacher's license, but he didn't.
So that's the core of the attack there. Are there going to be other items, you think, in the Republican arsenal here?
I think you'll see more versions of this ad. I get the impression that the Republican Party, for example, has pulled other records of teachers who did things that were questionable and did not lose their licenses. They're trying to build a case that Evers has neglected this responsibility. Now, the question I get from Democrats is this. Will voters really buy that the guy who was a teacher, then a principal, and now the head of Wisconsin schools would willingly allow people accused of this kind of behavior to remain in the classroom? If they have a hard time with that, then these attacks might not be effective. Also, if you hear so much of it now, I mean, we've got still 5 weeks of the election. Is this attack, does it lose its kind of potency as you're closer to October, November, because you keep using it over and over again? That's, you know, something to watch. Is it effective if they keep running it constantly now on November 6th?
Talking to J.R. Ross from Wispolitics.com, looking at the race for governor in Wisconsin. Now, you mentioned the Democratic Governors Association and Stronger Wisconsin PAC on the Democratic side, on the Evers, pro-Evers side, I should say. They're getting into the game. They released an ad criticizing Governor Walker over the issue of pre-existing condition coverage. It features a woman with breast cancer talking about how her coverage could be denied.
If Scott Walker takes away the protections for pre-existing conditions, I won't be able to afford the treatments that are saving my life. It's a matter of life and death for me. Scott Walker just doesn't seem to care about families like mine.
So can you give us some background on that ad, JR?
This is based off of, there was a House GOP bill that cleared that chamber that would have allowed states to seek waivers from the requirements that or the preventions of you being able, or insurance companies being able to charge those with pre-existing conditions more for their coverage. Now, at the time, Scott Walker said he would consider seeking a waiver, but he then later said no, and that he called on the state legislature to pass a law at the Wisconsin level to protect those with pre-existing conditions. So obviously Walker's campaign is pushing back on this. Democrats, however, point out that Walker supports a lawsuit filed by a number of states, including Wisconsin, with our Attorney General Brad Schimmel, that would overturn the Affordable Care Act, which includes protections for those with pre-existing conditions. Either way, the question I have is, will Walker and or Republicans put up some kind of response ad? If they think it's that false, will they fight it back? If you fight back, do you actually highlight their attack? But this is obviously something that the DGA sees as a weakness for Walker, because I've seen polling that has health insurance or health care as a major concern for voters, particularly with suburban college-educated women. The Republican Party nationally and in Wisconsin has struggled in poll after poll and election after election with those voters. We saw it in places like Doug Jones, Alabama, sorry. Alabama, forget my states, elections in Virginia last fall. We've seen it weakness with even in some legislative races in 2016 in Wisconsin, where Donald Trump did poorly in Milwaukee suburban areas that traditionally been Republican strongholds. They are struggling, Republicans are, with these voters. That's the target demographic for an ad like this. You know, somebody struggling with breast cancer, talking about health care, that's really who the Democrats are targeting with that ad.
Now, some stories in the news just over the last week that could be apparently bad news for Governor Walker, a third former Walker administration official coming out critical of the governor. This is DOT Secretary Mark Gottlieb, longtime Republican legislator before he was the Department of Transportation secretary. He accused Walker of being not entirely truthful in talking about highway expansion plans and roads funding. Give us that story.
So Mark Gottlieb was a former Republican lawmaker, former local official, who joined Walker's administration right after he was elected governor in 2010. Gottlieb has, you know, basically been on a different page than the governor for a while now when it comes to transportation funding. He actually produced a budget proposal in 2014, right after Walker won re-election, that proposed a series of fee and tax hikes to cover transportation costs. He left the administration more than a year ago. They just were on the same page. And what I don't know is, you know, will Mark Lee Gottlieb by himself saying that Governor Walker is being disingenuous about transportation spending, will that become an ad or an issue in the race? I don't know that. I get the impression, though, in talking to folks, that the roads issue is an important one in polling that they've seen. That if you're a Democrat, you can roll in the roads issue, schools, and other things, and make it a case of the prisons issue with the youth prison up in northern Wisconsin, the problems that were there. Make it a case about Scott Walker has fallen down the job of managing state government. So that's how it might play out moving toward November.
J.R. Ross is with us from Wispolitics. We're talking about the race for governor, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your takeaways from the Evers and Walker campaigns so far? What's the most important issue for you in the race for governor? These ads we're talking about, are they important? Do you think they affect your vote? Are they bringing up at least important issues in this race? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the race for Wisconsin governor with J.R. Ross, editor of Wispolitics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for J.R. about what's going on in the race? What do you think? What issue is important for you? What are your thoughts on the ads on TV and radio for this race? Have you been seeing them? Or online, as you play Words with Friends, say, or watch on YouTube, are you seeing those ads pop up? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls, Saeed is with us in Green Bay. Saeed, hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. This issue of the teacher's ad is just the tip of a very large iceberg. The iceberg is that the teacher's union's rules controlling arbitration protect teachers at the expense of students. The question is, what will government do? Is government there to bend to the special interest of WEAC, or is government there to protect our children and protect their education? And that's the point. It's not about this one individual a teacher. It's about the fact that the Democratic Party, wholly owned subsidiary of WEAC, is advancing the interest of teachers at the expense of students. And we see poor performing schools with no hope of ever improving their performance right now, given the framework that is reform-proof.
Saeed, thanks a lot for the call. And J.R. Saeed's hitting on, a long-running tension, is probably understating, between teachers' unions and Governor Walker and his supporters, definitely going back to Act 10, if not earlier.
Yeah, well, there is a layer of this with Governor Walker that he wants to portray Tony Evers as being beholden more to the teachers' union than to parents and students. WEAC, quite frankly, it doesn't have the power it used to have in Wisconsin politics after Act 10. It does not have the financial resources. It is still an important constituency, however, to Democrats and Democratic candidates. But I don't know that that argument about the union is what wins out for Governor Walker or what he thinks will win out with him with this. It's more about the idea of, you know, Tony Evers, the charge, they're leaving students vulnerable in the classroom. That's the message they keep pushing. So you haven't seen the union piece yet in the ads. It's all about the kids and letting these teachers remain in the classroom.
Saeed, thanks for the call. Go to Joanne now in Menominee. Joanne, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Mark Gottlieb is a civil engineer. He knows highways. He was the secretary to the Department of Transportation. He knows highways. Scott Walker either refuses to fund highways or he just hasn't figured out how to do so, because it's very possible to fund highways, and he could do it. The reason that he hasn't is very telling about Scott Walker. Why does not he want to fund highways?
Joanne, thanks for the call. And JR, as you were touching on earlier, Democrats think roads, potholes, road maintenance, road repairs could be a winning issue for them.
Yeah, and her question she asked, why won't Walker fund roads? I'm guessing she's asking, why won't he put more money into roads? The honest answer is that Scott Walker does not like tax hikes, period. And in talking to people around politics about this in Wisconsin, you know, there's an idea that Governor Walker could still run for president again someday. You don't win Republican primaries for national office by raising taxes, just kind of basic politics, right? So I just, in talking to people, they don't see a way that Walker would sign a gas tax hike of some sort if he's elected to a third term, a big if, right? More likely people will see him transferring money from other areas to pay for roads than doing a gas tax hike. And he's pushing this issue on Evers, saying, well, okay, if Evers says all options are on the table, well, what's that mean? Would it mean a buck hike in the gas tax? Evers says no, but he's not to be specific just yet. But Walker just is not a fan of tax hikes, and I don't see an option right now or a possibility of him signing a gas tax hike, barring something really dramatic that people aren't seeing that I talk to.
Joanne, thanks for the call. Go down to Jason in Algoma. Jason, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about Jason?
I would just like to mention that we have another option in Phil Anderson, the Libertarian Party candidate. He is also running for governor.
And is he somebody who you are thinking of voting for, Jason?
Yeah, I was a Walker supporter the first couple times around, and I think that, you know, Governor Walker did what he did, and I'm not going to vote for him this time because of some environmental concerns, some things like that. But Tony Evers has never inspired me as a candidate, and so I'm going to go with Phil Anderson.
Jason, thanks for the call. JR, do you see a risk of some people not being real excited about either major party candidate, as Jason is not?
I just got an email yesterday from a Republican operative who worried about that very thing, that in this environment that maybe some people who supported Walker in the past would look elsewhere. Now, we looked at the Marquette poll a few weeks ago, and I think Phil Anderson was around 6%, I want to guess. But the poll director, Charles Franklin, pointed out that typically in polls like this, that the farther you're out from the election, the higher the third-party candidate does, because people either haven't locked in or are not thrilled with their options. But as we get closer to the election day, typically the third-party share of the polls drops. The last time a third-party candidate did really well in Wisconsin was Ed Thompson, 2002. He cracked 10%. We haven't come close to that for anybody since then. Ralph Nader in 2000 did, 3 points, I think, in the presidential race. What I'm getting at is I don't see right now, talking to people, a big push toward a third-party candidate that might win. But there is definitely a fear, especially among Republicans, that if Walker has inspired certain people and they're not inclined toward Evers because of policy differences, will they sit it out? Or will they go to a third-party candidate? Likewise, there is this big question come November about the Trump voter. We kind of look back at 2016, and there was a surge for Trump in western and northern Wisconsin. We kind of think there are people who hadn't really voted before, been active, but were kind of pulled out by Donald Trump. A big question is, will those voters come to the polls in November? A challenge for Republicans is, how do you inspire those folks? By the way, if you play on Donald Trump's issues, you risk alienating people in, like, the Milwaukee suburbs who are part of the traditional GOP base.
And that's a good place to leave it. Thanks to J.R. Ross from WisPolitics joining us with the latest in the race for Wisconsin governor. Like much of rural Wisconsin, farmers in Monroe County helped elect President Donald Trump in the 2016 election, but new tariffs on U.S. agricultural products prompted by the president's trade policies could be a factor in this year's election. In our election year Beyond the Ballot project, Hope Kerwin brings us more.
At an auction house in Sparta, sales are between local buyers and sellers. But dairy farmer Bob Pronchinski knows the price he pays for Holstein calves is directly related to the world market.
We have to have foreign trade. Anybody can figure that out.
Pronchinski says he's worried about the future of exports. Since President Donald Trump placed new tariffs on steel and aluminum imports in March, trading partners like China and Mexico have placed their own taxes on U.S. agricultural products like cheese and soybeans. Trump says the tariff strategy will make trade more fair for U.S. producers. Pronchinski says farmers who voted for the president are watching the situation closely.
If this tariff works, yes, he's going to be a great, great president. If this foreign trade all works out for us, yeah, we'll have prices where they need to be. But the big question mark is if it's going to work.
In Wisconsin, at least some voters are starting to think the tariffs could work. When retaliatory tariffs took effect in July, a Marquette University law school poll showed only 24% of voters in the state thought Trump's new tariffs were good for the economy. But the latest Marquette poll found 34% of voters now support the tariffs. Part of the shift comes from more Republicans voicing their support. The Republican candidate for U.S. Senate, Leah Vukmir, says she backs Trump's trade strategy.
He knows that we are losing on that ground, and he wants to make sure that we have fair deals. He believes in free markets, as do I, but we have to have fair deals.
Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin has long defended the use of tariffs against countries that don't follow fair trade practices. But she says Trump went too far.
In those instances, they're appropriate, but the Trump administration has gone far beyond that in imposing these tariffs on Canada, on Mexico, and the countries in the European Union.
When it comes to agriculture, University of Wisconsin-Madison dairy analyst Mark Stevenson says increased exports have helped the industry grow over the last decade.
Agriculture has been a positive net trade balance for the U.S. In other words, we export more agricultural products than we import.
Stevenson says trade deals like the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, have encouraged countries to import more U.S. products, especially dairy. Now, the U.S. ag economy depends on exports to stay profitable. But even as those exports are threatened, Stevenson says it's not clear whether tariffs will affect how people vote. Beef farmer Steve Murray says the issue he'll be thinking about in the voting booth is simple.
To stay in business. So for me, it's to get the right person in there that supports what we do to put food on the table.
Murray says farmers need stability to be able to plan for the future. But price reactions to the new tariffs and promises of aid from the federal government have created a lot of uncertainty about what he'll actually earn this year.
They say that if we're patient, it will all iron out. The only problem is, how long can we be patient, and at what point patience runs out?
He says whatever profits he loses during this year's trade disputes will make it that much harder for him to farm again next year. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can hear more Beyond the Ballot pieces at WPR.org/ballot.